fired up.
When he says he wants to be a dictator, I believe him.
The president hits the trail.
Trump and I have a very different value set of Anunnabis already.
As the former president hits back.
It's not an age thing, it's a competence thing.
And razor thin.
We're going to have a knife fight over every single district.
We go one-on-one with the party leaders in charge of winning the House.
The Republicans are vulnerable because they're not governing. They're in charge of a do-nothing Congress.
Plus, with control of the Senate in the balance, we sit down with Carrie Lake.
Do you still believe that your election was stolen?
And spring forward.
What we're doing now is bad for health.
Will Congress make daylight saving time permanent?
In this place, there's always someone that has a reason to be against something.
Inside Politics, the best reporting from inside the quarters of power, starts now.
Good morning. Welcome to Inside Politics Sunday. I'm Manu Raju. There are 240 days to go until voters head to the polls in an absolutely vicious campaign rematch between President Biden and former President Trump is already taking shape, all with enormous stakes for the country and the world. The two men held dueling events last night in the battleground state of Georgia.
But we all know Donald Trump sees a different America, an American story of resentment, revenge, and retribution. We see a future where we defend the basic freedoms, not take them away. We see a future where we reward work, not just wealth. A future for all Americans. A presidency for all Americans. Now join me. Get out the vote. Vote, vote, vote.
For President Biden, the event was part of a far more aggressive campaign as he tries to take on one of his biggest vulnerabilities, his age of 81, and tries to rebuild a fraying coalition and reverse his sagging poll numbers. The former president, meanwhile, took to the rally stage with one of his fiercest congressional allies, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who had engaged in a tense exchange over immigration with Biden during the State of the Union last week, a speech Trump attacked as he ridiculed Biden's stutter.
Two nights ago, we all heard Crooked Joe's angry, dark, hate-filled rant of a State of the Union address. Didn't it bring us together? Remember, he said, I'm going to bring the country together. I'm going to bring it together.
It's not an age thing. It's a competence thing.
All right, let's break this all down with my great panel this morning, CNN's Melanie Zanona, Isaac Arnsdorf from The Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal's Catherine Lucy. Good morning to you all. It's been a busy weekend again, which is good for us to talk about, a lot to digest, including how the Biden campaign is, there's clearly a new phase in this campaign. Post-State of the Union, a more precise messaging operation, a new multi-million dollar ad campaign, and just stepping into higher gear. Look at what their plans are. Over 100 new battleground offices they announced that they're opening. They're hiring 350 new staff members. They put out this $30 million ad buy list. They're going to unveil it over the course of the next 6 weeks, put it all across media. Catherine, give us a sense of what the strategy is inside the Biden campaign as they move into this new phase.
Yeah, they really saw the State of the Union as kind of the kickoff, right, of the general election, post-Super Tuesday. They're pumping money into ads, into these battleground states. And that's really where you're going to see the fight, is in these states, as you saw the president out in Georgia and in Michigan. He's going to be out in other states in the next coming week. And they're really trying to do a – but I think two key things. One is they're trying to address the age thing head on. You see in this ad – they're trying to say, look, it's age is experience. I'm able to do things for you because of my age, because of my background. And then they're really trying to draw this very sharp contrast with Donald Trump and talk about how they see his policies as dangerous. You saw the president saying he'd be a dictator, that he's going to threaten your freedoms. And they're going to talk a lot about key freedoms like voting rights and abortion.
Yeah, and look, we saw that you mentioned the ad that came out just yesterday. They announced this as part of this massive ad buy and taking on the issues that voters say they're concerned about, the president's age.
Look, I'm not a young guy. That's no secret. But here's the deal. I understand how to get things done for the American people. For 4 years, Donald Trump tried to pass an infrastructure law, and he failed.
I got it done. Donald Trump took away the freedom of women to choose. I'm determined to make Roe v. Wade the law of the land again. Donald Trump believes the job of the president is to take care of Donald Trump. I believe the job of the president is to fight for you.
Can we do one more take?
Look, I'm very young, energetic, and handsome. What the hell am I doing this for?
And look, this came right after Trump's Super PAC put out an ad going after Joe Biden's age, even though Trump is just 4 years younger.
We can all see Joe Biden's weakness. If Biden wins, can he even survive till 2029? The real question is, can we?
Can he even survive? Woof! How do you see this playing out?
Yeah, and the Trump campaign followed up and basically put those two ads together. They took the clip from the beginning of the Biden ad of him saying, I get that I'm old, and then all those clips of him showing his age. And the Biden campaign argument here is basically there are worse things than being old and drawing that contrast with Trump. And it's interesting to hear the way that Trump talks about it as well when he says this isn't about age is just a number. This is about something else because they're very aware, and Trump himself is very aware, that he's not that far behind Biden.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And meanwhile, Trump is, as we know, has so many legal issues that are going to be a major factor as we head into the campaign season. They hope it's not. They want to delay, of course, those criminal trials. They may be successful. We'll see how all this ultimately plays out. But then he's got the civil issues in too, as well as the $91 million bond that he had to post on Friday as he appealed that judgment in the case against him in the E. Jean Carroll case in New York. He was found liable for both sexual abuse and defamation in 2022. And defamation, just remember that, because last night Trump at this rally brought it up, and we'll see if that leads to any legal issues for him.
I just posted a $91 million bond, $91 million, on a fake story, totally made up story. I got sued for defamation. That's where it starts. And this is Democrat operatives. These are all her lawyers, a big Democrat operative. This woman is not a believable person.
All right. Let's just remind. He owes her, has decided, $83.3 million for reputational repair, emotional harm, and punitive damages for malicious statements. And he says this. He just can't help himself.
Yeah, and one thing I was looking out for was whether he would shift his message in any way now that we are in more of a general election rematch, because this was so much part of his message in the primary. He was using these court cases to paint himself as a victim and a martyr, and it worked, at least with the GOP base. But I think it's another question when it comes to a general election. How much are you going to want to bring up these court trials when you're on the campaign trail? Even he is going to have to juggle them in terms of the calendar, but it's not something that I'm sure his team wants him to be talking about all that much.
And will the Biden team even touch this? You know, especially they're not. Why?
I mean, so far they haven't. The president has not wanted to go there. You could see this from, you know, outside groups or Democrats. But I think the Biden team really wants to focus on the policy contrast. And that's really what you're going to see, is them continue to make this argument about here's what another Donald Trump term would look like compared to what another Joe Biden term would look like.
It was notable, though, that Biden was campaigning miles away from Fulton County, where Donald Trump is facing criminal charges. So it does seem like they're trying to acknowledge it in some ways, even if they're not addressing it.
Yeah, and we're seeing them just side by side more, right? We saw them both down at the border also. So you're going to see more of these moments where they're sort of thrust together.
And meanwhile, the Biden team is dealing with, and Trump really, the threat of third-party candidates, the independent candidacy of RFK Jr., qualifying for a pair of battleground states, like Michigan in particular. That one is going to be a big battle in November. In Nevada, New Hampshire, and Hawaii, the campaign says they met the signature threshold to qualify. In Michigan, South Carolina, Georgia, and Arizona, they say they've met enough. The Super PAC also says they've met enough to qualify. Who does RFK Jr. pose a bigger threat to, Trump or Biden?
This is an ongoing debate. Both campaigns have obviously tested it in polling, and they can make arguments one way or the other. And you can see the thinking kind of shift when Trump will attack him or not attack RFK Jr. But we've all seen in elections going back to 2000 how a few thousand votes to a third party candidate can tip a very close state.
Yeah, and we'll see if that happens again. All right, coming up, a Republican senator's shocking and misleading story. It was fodder for SNL last night.
Good evening. I'm Abby Phillips.
First and foremost, I'm a mom. And like any mom, I'm going to do a pivot out of nowhere into a shockingly violent story about sex trafficking. And rest assured, every detail about it is real, except the year, where it took place, and who was president when it happened.
Yeah, she was good.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot-scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Freshman Senator Katie Britt told a jarring story this past week during the Republican response to the State of the Union address, a graphic tale of sexual violence she said she heard at the southern border.
I spoke to a woman who shared her story with me. She had been sex trafficked by the cartels starting at the age of 12. She told me not just that she was raped every day, but how many times a day she was raped. This is the United States of America, and it is past time, in my opinion, that we start acting like it. President Biden's border policies are a disgrace.
But the incident did not happen during the Biden administration or even in the United States, but actually in Mexico. In a statement to CNN, her office defended that passage from her speech, claiming that the story was in line with the problems at the border, saying that during that, quote, dangerous journey to cross into the United States, children, women, and men are being subjected to gut-wrenching, heartbreaking horrors in our own backyard. Our panel is back. This was really supposed to be a shining moment for Katie Brick, someone who is being elevated in the Republican ranks, given this huge opportunity. She's faced just enormous criticism for her delivery, but now this passage was not true the way she presented it. What's the fallout?
Yeah, I mean, the story itself that she told is not inaccurate. What's dishonest is the way she tried to link it to the Biden administration, the way she tried to link it to something that was happening in the United States. And it was just such an unforced error for her, in addition to picking the kitchen table as the setting, in addition to the delivery, which was widely criticized and mocked. And this is just the risk of doing the rebuttal. These things are notoriously tricky. You're going from watching the president in this room with hundreds of people, there's a lot of energy, to watching someone deliver a straight-to-camera alone in a room. And we've seen how this has tripped up past politicians, including rising stars. It looked like it's happened to her as well. I mean, I would say I don't think this means her end is near because in the future of the Republican Party, she still has a very long career ahead of her. But it's embarrassing.
Yeah, like Marco Rubio is still around. He had the water bottle moment, and he's a senior member in the Senate as well. So, look, this all came, of course, during the State of the Union. There was that unscripted moment that happened that actually got Biden in a bit of hot water with his own party when Marjorie Taylor Greene during the State of the Union said, say out the name of Laken Riley, of course, a 22-year-old Georgian student who was allegedly killed at the hands of someone who is in the country illegally. Biden used the term illegal immigrant, and that caused some backlash on the left. And he was asked about that last night, and he walked back that specific word.
An undocumented person. And I shouldn't have used illegal. It's undocumented. And look, when I spoke about the difference between Trump and me, one of the things I talked about on the border was that the way he talks about vermin, the way he talks about these people polluting the blood. I talked about what I'm not going to do, what I won't do. I'm not going to treat any of these people with disrespect. Look, they built the country.
And then last night in Rome, Georgia, Trump went after Biden for that walk back.
No, he was illegal. And I say he was an illegal alien. He was an illegal immigrant. He was an illegal migrant. And he shouldn't have been in our country, and he never would have been under the Trump policy.
And Biden should be apologizing for apologizing to this killer.
Trump also met with Lincoln Riley's parents at that event. How do you see this playing out?
Well, you can see Biden sometimes likes being attacked from the left on immigration. It makes him look more moderate and appeal to the voters that he needs to win this election. So he's looking for those moments where he can kind of call the Republicans' bluff. Is, I will shut down the border. I do want to pass this border bill. I will say Lincoln Riley's name. And there are ways that they're clearly, you know, a lot of Americans can relate to maybe not always using the most PC word. That was a big part of Donald Trump's appeal.
And look, one of the reasons why Biden was under pressure was concerns and criticism on the left over not just the terminology. That's one aspect of it, but also his shift on immigration. He did, on this bipartisan border security deal, move much further to the Republican position. And that angered so many folks on the left who say you're ceding on this issue where they thought they had the high ground just years ago, and now they fear that they don't. And I caught up with one senior Democrat in the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, Joaquin Castro of Texas, who had a warning for the president.
He's got to be careful not to go down the dark path that Donald Trump has taken us when he talks about the border and he talks about immigration. Because what Donald Trump has done in his rhetoric is put a target on people's backs. That's part of what concerns me is when I heard that, because the president has tacked to his right on policy. It's a big concern, not just for Hispanics, but Democratic voters. We need Democratic voters to come out. And I don't want us to do things that fundamentally deflate the inspiration and the willingness of Democrats to come out and vote.
And that's an interesting comment. I don't want to do things that fundamentally deflate the inspiration and the willingness of Democrats to come out and vote. In other words, you go to the middle on immigration, you risk angering the left, and that is just the balancing act that Biden has struggled with on this issue.
That's the line that he's trying to walk, and it's a really hard one, especially if you think about what Biden is trying to do to win this election is bring back this coalition of people who voted for him in 2020. And that includes a lot of young people, a lot of activists, a lot of folks who don't like the kind of immigration policies that he has been supporting. And so the idea that some people might sit on the bench or sit on the couch is a real concern.
Yeah, and that is definitely the concern they're going to have to deal with in the months ahead. All right, coming up, We go one-on-one with the party leaders charged with winning a majority in the House. And then we'll speak with Republican Carrie Lake in one of the nation's most important Senate races. The battle for the House is on a knife's edge, with a limited number of pickup opportunities for both parties and the likelihood that the next majority could also be razor thin. But the leaders in charge of each party's strategy detailed to me this past week how they see the playing field and how candidates in swing districts will adjust to the top of their tickets. Right now, Republicans only have a 219-213 majority, and Democrats are targeting 17 GOP-held seats in District Biden won, while Republicans are focused on 5 Democratic-held seats in districts Trump won, and on 4 other swing district seats currently held by Democrats who are retiring this year. And even as Republicans have struggled to govern in this messy and chaotic 118th Congress, they are bullish about their chances in November. Congressman Richard Hudson, who chairs the House GOP's campaign arm, says Trump will help his candidates.
Are you going to hold the majority?
Absolutely. We're going to grow the majority for several reasons. The political environment is the best political environment Republicans have had in a long time. Mainly because Biden's policies have failed. Also because of the recruits. We got the best recruitment class we've ever had. If you look at the battleground, you know, the 250-seat majority days are gone because of redistricting. You know, we're going to have a knife fight over every single district. But you look at 4 Democrat swing seat retirements. They're great pickup opportunities for us.
How did Super Tuesday change things for you?
It was a huge help for us.
So you've talked to Donald Trump. You were in Mar-a-Lago talking about some of these races. Can he be helpful in the 18 Biden districts where Republicans serve?
Absolutely.
But how? I mean, like, he can't be popular in those districts.
Well, right now he's popular everywhere. He's winning every battleground state. And I think the turnout models are much different in a presidential election year for us. It brings out a lot of voters that don't vote in the midterms. And so I think it's a net positive.
And what if he's convicted? Will that make it harder for you guys to hold the majority?
I think most Americans see these all as what they are. I mean, it's political politically motivated.
Will you encourage your members to campaign with Donald Trump?
Sure. I mean, each candidate can make up their own mind what they want to do. I'll be campaigning with President Trump, and I think he's going to help us across the ticket.
Look, in some ways, you expect a campaign chairman to be very optimistic and bullish. But, look, this has been a period of time where Republicans, things have been going a little better for the GOP after all everything that we've seen. Super Tuesday went as generally as they hoped. Redistricting fights have not been as bad as they feared, particularly in New York. And Biden numbers are not helping them. But despite all that, they have a lot of real challenges, Trump being one of them. Is Hudson being realistic about growing the majority?
Yeah, I mean, I think the pool of potential battleground districts, as he mentioned there, it's shrunk because in recent years there's just been so much redistricting and gerrymandering that you're not going to see a 60-seat wave on either side. So it is going to be a smaller pool. It is going to be a knife fight, as he said. But I will say that up until this point, Republicans have really felt like they could lose the majority in November, that that was going to be the case. It has started to shift a little bit. They see immigration and the border as a huge issue for them. They feel like they have the wind at their backs. J.R. Majewski, a controversial Republican candidate in a key primary, dropped out. There have been a couple things breaking their ways, which is fueling that confidence you heard from Hudson. But it's going to be tough. It's going to be close for both parties, and abortion is still a huge, huge liability for Republicans.
Absolutely. It's a big liability, and the Trump top of the ticket always has an impact down ticket, and you're facing two pretty unpopular candidates for president. So what does that mean down ticket? That's a question that I also put to the Democratic Campaign Committee Chairwoman Suzanne DelBene about the top of their ticket and the impact that it will have on her vulnerable members. So I just spoke to Richard Hudson, and he told me that Republicans will not only hold the majority, they will grow the majority. What do you say to him?
I strongly disagree. And all you have to do is go talk to voters across the country. They're tired of the extremism, the lack of interest in actually governing from Republicans. They're in charge of a do-nothing Congress.
You think they should campaign? Your candidates should campaign with Biden?
I think we've had candidates campaigning. I think they're out there. Our map is always going to be a little different in terms of where the congressional races are and where there might be the most focus from a presidential standpoint. But I think the president has a strong record.
Hudson also thinks that Trump actually will be a net benefit because it can energize the base and bring out voters. He does not think it's going to hurt them in their 18 Biden Republican districts. What's your reaction to that?
Well, they're incapable of making a decision on their own. They are the party of Donald Trump.
You know, what's interesting is that you don't see as many vulnerable members embracing Biden, perhaps as you might see among Republican members. Maybe there's a difference in how they handle it. How do you think these members in these districts and in the Senate races, too, will deal with Biden when they come to when he comes to their states and districts?
And that's always a calculation we see every cycle for folks in some of these swingy districts. But, you know, Biden is obviously running at the top of the ticket, and it's hard to run away from that, obviously.
Some try,
and there has been some chatter about people being worried about whether Biden will be a drag at the top of the ticket. You're seeing, obviously, the president's campaign investing a lot in battleground areas, trying to get a lot of, you know, boots on the ground, a lot of staffing, trying to, you know, elevate this message that he is helpful and is delivering, which I think in a lot of these swing districts is key. They want to really show voters that they have been delivering on priorities like infrastructure, mm-hmm. like healthcare and so forth.
So I mentioned Republicans who are embracing Trump, but there are actually a fair amount in the House and the Senate who simply are just not there yet. I asked just a lot of Republicans about the fact that Trump, you know, after Super Tuesday, he became the presumptive nominee. He was on the way to the nomination. So what? Are they going to get behind him? Some of them just wouldn't answer. Are you ready to endorse Trump? Are you going to endorse Mr. Kane? Mr. Kane, can you respond? Are you going to endorse him?
Look, at the end of the day, this is about the American people. They will determine who the next president of the United States is. Not me, not anybody in this House or chamber.
Are you going to endorse Trump?
What I will tell you is that we can't afford four more years of Biden administration.
Are you going to support Trump?
What's that?
Are you supporting Trump?
Figure that out. Thanks.
Are you going to vote for him?
I've answered that question before.
So Trump is the nominee. Are you going to support him?
What Hoosiers decide to do is Hoosiers' choice. I don't have anything to say about my own views on the election. I've said enough.
But you still harbor those same concerns?
nothing's changed from my standpoint. I trust the people I represent to make their own decisions about who they're going to vote for.
I mean, some of those senators are not up for re-election, like Senator Todd Young, and he's not there yet, and a lot of the members aren't. What do you think of that?
I didn't know Billy on the Street was back on the air. I think it probably is trickier actually in the Senate, where there's a lot of overlap between the seats that the Democrats are defending, whereas in the House and the battleground states for the presidential, whereas in the House, I mean, a lot of this is going to be like you said, in New York, where the Democrats have pickup opportunities because of the redistricting.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, some of them who are in those swing districts, the Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick being one of them, wouldn't say if he's supporting Trump. Mike Lawler said he didn't want to get into that. And others, Congressman Dan Newhouse, one of 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump, not saying if he will endorse him here. But you're seeing that's the Republican hand-wringing about Trump that is clearly still existing. And then there's the Republican political operation, their strategy. We talked about immigration in the last segment. There was a vote last week in the House on a bill named after Lincoln Riley. Democrats said it was a overreach, that Republicans were taking advantage of a tragic situation, and a lot of them didn't vote for it. Well, the ones who didn't vote for it are now being hit by a new campaign ad from the House GOP campaign arm going after them for their votes.
Joe Biden's open border caused this. Even worse, extreme House Democrats refused to protect victims.
And you're seeing that ad here for the first time. Melanie, what's behind this? It's pretty clear what they're trying to do here. But look, they successfully campaigned on crime in past election cycles. They're trying to replicate that same
strategy. And here they're actually linking crime and the border, what they see are going to be their two biggest issues come November. And they're going to go after Democrats repeatedly on this issue, not just on that vote. They're going to use everything against them that they can. And you even saw Democratic leadership allowing members to vote their conscience on that piece of legislation, because they knew that there were some Democrats who were going to have to vote yes for it. And a lot of them who vote yes were those vulnerable Democrats in November.
Yeah, absolutely, including some of them who ran for the Senate. And speaking of the Senate, control of the Senate is also up for grabs in November. It could all come down to Arizona. Up next, our conversation with Republican candidate Carrie Lake.
Do you still believe that your election was stolen?
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the nation's most critical battleground states is in Arizona, where not only the presidential candidates will be battling for its 11 electoral votes, but it's also a state that could determine control of the Senate. And just last week, there was a major shakeup in the Senate race when independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who caucuses with Democrats, announced she would not run again. And that paved the way for a hugely significant head-to-head race between Carrie Lake, a MAGA and Trump-aligned conservative, and progressive Democrat Ruben Gallego. Our Melanie Zanona sat down one-on-one with Carrie Lake soon after the news broke that Sinema would not run again.
Kyrsten Sinema said she is not going to be running for re-election. Yes. Do you think this makes the path easier for you in Arizona?
I think it does. I think, you know, she obviously was looking at the polling, the same polling that we're looking at, and I'm sure Ruben Gallego's been looking at, and she was going to get anywhere between 14 and maybe 18% of the vote. That's just not enough to win a race. It's not enough to win an election. So I think it actually does help us. I think she was pulling a few Democrats and a few Republicans as well, and a few independents. Yes.
But as she tries to appeal to moderate voters, Lake is answering questions about her past, including her bogus claims of widespread election fraud in her loss in the governor's race in 2022 and Trump's re-election bid in 2020.
If you had been vice president, would you have certified the 2020 election results?
These are crazy. This is like a hypothetical going forward and a hypothetical going backward. I'm not going to entertain that. What I will entertain is talking about how do we go forward. And going forward, when we get an America First president and some great leadership in the Senate and the majority, we're going to do great things for the American people.
Do you still believe that your election was stolen?
We had major problems in our election, and we're really working to resolve those problems. We still have some court cases. What I'm concerned about going forward in the next election is that my radical opponent, Ruben Gallego, wants to give 9 to 12 million people who've poured in illegally, invaded our country, the ability to vote. He wants them all to vote. That's wrong.
Did anyone give you advice to not talk about the 2020 election?
No. The 2020 election, I think it was a rigged election. President Trump, I believe it was. But what I'm trying to do is look forward.
Gallego's office said he was not available for an interview, but his spokesman released a statement to us saying, quote, Carrie Lake will say or do anything to gain power, including ban abortion and challenge the results of the 2020 and 2022 elections. And Melanie Zonina, who you saw there, of course, is here. So what do you make of the great interview, by the way, and what do you make of the fact of her move here? She's sort of trying to moderate, but also embracing those same claims in the past and same positions, but recognizes that this is a state with a huge amount of independent voters, and she has to appeal to them.
And especially with Sinema out of the race, there's this huge pool of independents and centrists who are up for grabs. Clearly, both her and Gallego are trying to make a play for those. And she's tried to moderate her position on a number of things. She's tried to mend some fences, including with John McCain and his family. She famously criticized John McCain in the past. She's tried to walk back some of her positions on abortion, which is, again, going to be a huge issue. And you heard her there denying the 2020 election and saying, I still want to look forward, though. I don't want to talk about this stuff, even though she can't help herself but still embrace what has been central to her MAGA firebrand identity, which is election denialism. And I think it's really, you can see in the interview how much she was struggling with trying to express moderate positions while also not keeping her base at an arm's distance, the base that made her into the candidate she is today.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating race. And meanwhile, you talked to her about one of these issues that, of course, she may have to deal with it. She's a senator. What to do about Ukraine aid still stalled in Congress at a critical moment. The GOP is bitterly divided over this issue, and she has a very strong position about where she stands.
Would you support the foreign aid package that they ultimately did pass? It didn't include border, but it did include money.
I don't
Ukraine.
Support sending more money to Ukraine. When the spring offensive
under any circumstances?
I don't see a circumstance where I would. No, I think this is a war that's been lost.
This war has been lost. I mean, it speaks to where the base is on such a key issue.
Well, the Republican base, the MAGA base,
yeah.
and particularly trying to tie the issue of Ukraine funding to the U.S. border. But, can also, I know a lot of McCain Republicans who are not, in the mold of John McCain and much more interested in America's place in the world traditionally, and not ready to forgive and forget all those slights and insults from Carrie Lake.
Yeah. And look, this all comes as there are a bunch of competitive Senate races in November. If you look at the Senate map here, the challenge for Democrats, though, there are two states, Texas and Florida. Those are really their only pickup opportunities here. And that and the race for the majority goes through a number of states that Donald Trump won in 2020, including in Ohio, including in West Virginia, which is a retirement, the open seat there, Montana, who John Tester, who I caught up with last week. And I asked him about Biden's impact and what that may mean for his race.
Biden standing ahead of November is not good. So what does that do for you? I mean, the fact that he is really underwater versus Trump on almost all these issues, it can't be helpful for a guy running in Montana.
It's honest to goodness, it's a totally different race. We're running our own race. He's going to run his race. And I don't think it really matters much. I've got my own brand. We're going to talk about things I've done. We're going to talk about what I want to do in the future.
So I think the president will be in a close race, as I will be, and I think we're both
going to
win.
And that last comment coming from a Pennsylvania Democrat, Bob Casey, I mean, that's where Biden, of course, will be campaigning a lot. He's not going to Montana. Trump's going to win Montana. But Casey's made the determination, I got to stick with Biden. That's really how we're going to win together or we're going to lose together.
Yeah, and Biden won Pennsylvania in 2020. He's a Scranton native. His political brand dates back a long way there. There was a time when he was called the third Pennsylvania senator. So Bob Casey and Biden go way back, and he's clearly not going to move away from him. But their fortunes are absolutely going to rise or fall together, and that's a must-win state for Biden as well.
Yeah, I mean, but sometimes these Democratic senators, they have to run ahead of Biden in some of these states, like Sherrod Brown in Ohio, where Trump is going to be heavily favored to win there.
As well as Montana. Montana and Ohio, those are probably going to be some of the toughest states for Democrats to hold on to. And they don't have a lot of pickup opportunities either. Yeah. That's the other flip side, especially now that you have Joe Manchin. He stepped out of West Virginia. Yeah. That puts another one in Republicans' map.
That is almost certain to flip, of course. All right, coming up. On this day when the clocks spring forward, is it finally time for Congress to make daylight saving time permanent?
I never argued it's the most important issue facing the Republic, but it's one that matters. Everybody's got an opinion on it one way or the other.
It's that time of year when the clocks spring forward, and of course, we lose an hour of sleep. And that change brings us darker mornings, but also lighter evenings. And that's something many on Capitol Hill want year-round. Since 1966, states have been allowed to decide whether they make the biannual switch. But critics say switching back and forth is actually bad for our health. And 2 years ago, the Senate surprised many when it actually passed a bill to keep the U.S. permanently on daylight saving time. But the House never followed suit. And since then, nothing has happened. Senator Marco Rubio sponsored that Senate bill.
Why have you not been able to get this done?
Because in this place, there's always someone that has a reason to be against something. I mean, my view of it is we should just pick one and stick with it year-round. But it's a big country, so I guess at some point, some people will argue that it's too dark in the morning when kids go to school. The reverse is, you know, there's a lot of places in America where we want kids to be outdoors. And, you know, if you don't have lights at a park, you're pretty much done by 5 p.m., 4:30. So, but either way, my bigger challenge, my bigger complaint is switching back and forth. I don't get why we keep doing that.
Rubio's fellow Floridian, Republican Vern Buchanan, sponsored a similar bill in the House.
An hour change makes a big difference, especially with a lot of the seniors. I'm in Florida. So that extra hour, you can come home, get, you know, spend some time with the kids outside, go for a jog, whatever you want to do. That's what everybody's pushing me for the last 10 years.
But while Floridians might be happy with staying on daylight saving time, further north, that would mean sunrises in the winter as late as 9 a.m., and take it from Congressman Dan Newhouse, a Republican from Washington State.
I'm not opposed to staying on one time, but what I want to be sure of is that we pick the right time. And I'm not sure daylight savings is right. Standard may be the better
standard. Because in Washington State, it's dark.
That's right, yeah. So we've got to look at all the impacts and make the right choice. And then I think staying on one time makes sense.
But in the House, the bill remains stuck in the Energy and Commerce Committee, which happens to be chaired by a Republican Congresswoman from, you guessed it, Washington State. That chairwoman, Kathy McMorris-Rodgers, told me she does have, quote, concerns about making the time change permanent. And when I caught up with her on Friday, she would not say whether it's time for a change.
Is your committee going to move on that bill?
We're looking at the bill. We'll get back with you.
I guess only time will tell. That's it for Inside Politics Sunday. You can follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter, at MK Raju. Follow the show at Inside Politics. And if you ever miss an episode, you can catch up wherever you get your podcast. Just search for Inside Politics. Now, up next, State of the Union with Jake Tapper and Dana Bash. Jake's guests include Senators James Lankford and Raphael Warnock, as well as North Carolina's Democratic candidate for governor, Josh Stein. Thanks again for sharing your Sunday morning with us. We'll see you next time.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.